You're listening to Critical Reads. This show is designed to help people critically analyze topics like race, culture, and faith, one resource at a time. I am your host, Neff Lesperance. Hi there, and welcome to another exciting episode of Critical Reads, the podcast. As the intro says, I'm your host, Neff. I thank you so much again for joining me today on another episode. And for those of you who are new to the show, welcome. I'm super excited to be doing this project and continuing on this journey with you all. Sorry about not posting last week, but as I've mentioned in previous episodes, I'm trying to do this thing where I'm creating, obviously, but I'm also being kind to myself, given, you know, that I'm now an adult that's living back home and I'm working as a social worker in an inpatient facility for mental health. So, you know, there's some week that there's just so much going on that just for my own mental health, it's good for me to give myself a break and not overextend myself. So on those weeks, I do continue to invite you to be patient with me and wait for the next episode. But again, I'm always excited to be back here and I will continue to be doing this until, I don't know, maybe it stops being fun or I feel like this project is done. So today I'm super excited because we're going to be diving into this book that is called The Oxford Handbook of Feminist Theology. I'm super excited to talk about this book because this is one of the books that I read earlier in my journey of just deconstructing and just learning more about my world and challenging my worldview. So there's a lot of cool things that I'm hoping to talk about today. And I will be honest that this book is pretty heavy with a lot of information, so I'm not going to dive in too deeply on too many of the chapters because, A, again, I want you all to be able to read them, but then also I feel like if I go too deep into this book, instead of this podcast being an hour, it's going to be a lot longer. So today I'm mostly going to focus on a chapter or two, depending on time, and just talking about some of the things that really stood out to me in the book in general and how it helped me kind of see things a little bit differently when I first read this. And so I, like I've said before, the reason I'm doing some of the books that I've read first is just because I want to give you guys a little bit of an idea of how I think as I'm going through these first books. But then as I move further into the different resources, I want to, then I'll start jumping into books that I was just interested in reading. And I was like, what the hell? Let's process it together, you know? So eventually we'll start, you know, switching over to that. But before we get to the book, I wanted to take a minute and just start by diving into something I call Musings of a Tired Black Social Worker. And this is just a segment where I just take a minute to reflect on something interesting that caught my attention or has been on my mind the past week or so. And so for this week's musings, I wanted to kind of reflect on a quote that I saw that was shared on Twitter, but it was like reshared on Facebook and it just caught my eyes a few weeks ago. And it was something that I've just been pondering a lot. Also, especially given that, you know, today I'm talking about theology a bit. And so basically a person on Twitter named Ogbeni Demola, which I hope I didn't butcher this person's name, but she posted something on November 14, 2021 saying, "The white man built his heaven on our land and pointed ours to the sky." And you know, this quote really like stood out to me because I think that's something I've been struggling a lot with, you know, being in ministry spaces, being in nonprofit spaces, trying to do social work and also trying to figure out what my place in the church looks like these days. And I think it's really hard, especially given that, you know, in grad school, I learned a lot more about liberation theology and the idea of the reign of God being something that could be on this side of heaven and not just something that's like this magical idea when we all die that, oh, things are going to be better and blah, blah, blah. So we just have to power through, you know, the oppressive systems here and be okay with it. I don't know. This quote just kind of reminded me of like how my heart just kind of, you know, longs for this opportunity to built heaven on this side, right? And so I think it's been hard to just wrestle with how, you know, because of colonialism, because of white supremacy, obviously the people that are colonizers and people that are benefiting from white supremacy, in a way they are having this opportunity to have their idea of heaven be here and have their idea of happiness, success, all of these things here on earth. And instead of being open to us, you know, fighting collectively to make it better for everybody, they just keep, you know, telling us shit like, oh, don't worry, you know, you just have to count it all joy, and one day when you die, everything will be better. And I think that's my point, is that's what I grew up listening to in the church, where, you know, as a black person, as a brown person, when you're talking about oppressive systems, and the first few lines I would always hear is like, oh, you shouldn't be worried about race issues. It doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things, because God is what's most important and heaven is what's most important. But to me, I think hearing that language all the time, it was so demeaning and demoralizing and just undermining the things that I was feeling and what other people in my community and other communities that are being oppressed are experiencing. And so, yeah, I think that's where this quote was just like, man, like, I think the idealistic part of me has struggled so much, because I'm like, man, I would love for us to be able to work together as a collective and stop doing all these bullshit wars and supporting all these oppressive systems that are really not serving us in the long run, and try to work together collectively to figure out how to actually have a piece of heaven here on earth, you know? And it's hard. Like, and I know one of the things I was talking to a friend about actually last night is how it's been hard as a person that's very idealistic to not, like, just give up. I'm battling that with myself every day, where I'm like, I'm so tired of being in these church spaces, being in these nonprofit spaces, just being in spaces where I'm like, man, like, we can do so much better than what we're doing, but just feeling like nobody wants to hear you, and just everybody just wants to keep doing the same things. And even with that, like, I'm tired of watching the same few people constantly have to be creating content, creating workshops, creating things to try to get people to kind of see the point, you know, but they just don't want to do it. And so I think, given the situation that I even shared about what happened when I was working at my last nonprofit, it just came to a point where I was like, I'm over this. You know, being a person in these spaces that are constantly wanting more and seeing the potential for more, but then constantly being pushed by things that are systems that are just not really wanting to change. It's very hard to continue. And I know, like, a week ago or so, like, me and a few of my coworkers went out to dinner together to just kind of celebrate the holidays. And after dinner and everybody left, a small group of us, like about five of us, were talking about spirituality a little bit, because we all happen to be Christians. And again, I was like, man, I miss this. Like, it felt like, again, a piece of heaven that we were able to, like, come together. We were talking, we were dreaming, we were just reflecting on how we could use our talents as social workers and just people who care about people to do things better. And again, after that Friday and then going back to work the next week on Monday, I was hit again with, like, the realities that even if I really want to help people and want to make a difference, like, the system that I work in is so broken that it's just one of those things that I'm like, I'm always feeling like my hands are tied, you know? And so, yeah, I think it sucks. And that's where I'm like one of these, I'm in one of these spaces right now where I'm mourning the fact that things are kind of how they are. And again, the idealistic part of me just really wants something more for us as a people group, as a country, as a world. But that's just, you know, again, this is just kind of where we are right now. And so I did really appreciate this Twitter post, because it really spoke to just how, what it feels like right now, the realities that certain groups of people are just, it just feels like they're winning. it feels like, again, like they're building their heaven here. And, you know, we're just kind of having to wait around and hope that they might be willing to change their mind or be different. And it sucks. But, you know, right now it just is what it is. And I don't know. I know that's a little sad and a little, it feels defeating maybe, but it's real. It's just how I've been feeling lately. And so I know with that too, I'm very thankful for those who are out there that are still organizing, that are still creating content, that are still creating workshops or like creating spaces and opportunities to bring people together and still have these hard conversations and still try to fight the system where they can. But at the same time, I know like, man, it must be exhausting. So I feel for, you know, for them, and especially as we're starting to go into the holidays again, like I just hope that, you know, all the people that are doing these things and that you're just taking the time to take care of yourselves. And again, I see you and I appreciate the work that you're doing. So with that said, let's dive into this book. So as I mentioned before, the book that we're going to be talking about today is called The Oxford Handbook of Feminist Theology. This book was edited by two people, one named Sheila Briggs. The other one was named Mary McClintock. I apologize if I didn't say her name correctly, but both of these women essentially edited this book, and a lot of people came together from different religious backgrounds to kind of talk about this topic, feminism, with the theme kind of being focused on the idea of feminism and globalism and how those two kind of come together and impact different women around the world. And so just to give a little bit of an intro from the book's perspective, the authors of the book or the publishers of the book describe this book as, "This innovative volume highlights the relevance of globalization and the insights of gender studies and religious studies for feminist theology, beginning with a discussion of position of the discipline at the turn of the 21st century. The handbook seeks to present an inclusive account of feminist theology in the early 21st century that acknowledges the reflection of women in religion beyond the global north and its forms of Christianity. Globalization is taken as the central theme, as the foremost characteristic of the context in which we do feminist theology today. The volume traces the impacts of globalization on gender and religion in specific geographical contexts, describing the implications for feminist theologists' thinking. A final section explores the changing context of the field, moving towards new models of theology distinct from the structure and language of traditional Christian systematic theology and the forms of secular feminism." So some of the goals are that this book also is trying to do is kind of to, one, define the current field of feminist theology in a global context, drawing on the expertise of a team of 27 international contributors. They also try to address case studies from different world faiths, considering theory with regard to Buddhist, Christian, Hindu, Jewish, and Islamic theologies. And then lastly, they're also trying to suggest new models for discipline, drawing creatively on the traditions of Christian systematic theology and secular feminist thought. And so one of the things that I liked about this book, and I will note that the edition that I have, I think the first edition was published in 2012. So obviously there's a lot of things that have changed since then. But I did like that this book is very similar to the Deconstructionist Playbook that I read, that it wasn't just focused on one type of way to be a Christian or one type of way to do theology. So with this book, we have a lot of different ways of doing theology, a lot of different understandings of what it means to be a woman of faith that is not just, you know, Judeo-Christian centered, which is, I think, was really mind-blowing to me when I first read this book, especially given that I came from a Christian background where mostly all I read was books by evangelical Christians. And when the topic of theology came up, automatically my mind went to, you know, Jesus, Christian, you know, that's all we're studying about. And this book kind of reminds us that theology in general is just looking at the study of God, and it's, or the study of religion. It's not just focused on only the Christian Judeo version of what, like what we know here in the States, or the default, I should say, in the States. It also includes all these other backgrounds like Hinduism, the Jewish faith, Islamic faith, Buddhism, and all the other religious beliefs that we don't always think about, you know? And so, as we always do, let's look at the authors and hear a little bit more about, especially the two editors that put this together. So the first editor, Sheila, at the time of writing this book, it says that Sheila is an associate professor in the religion department at the University of Southern California. She researches feminist theology, particularly 19th and 20th century German theology, early Christianity, theories of history and modern liberation movements. Briggs currently studies the relation of attitudes towards gender and attitudes towards the Jewish Torah in the writings of Paul, the first century apostle. Other projects focuses on an ancient past that never happened except in the imagination of contemporary popular culture, such as the TV series Xena Warrior Princess. Very interesting. And then the other editor, Mary, they say that she is an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church, USA, and a professor of theology at Duke University Divinity School. She also teaches in Duke's Women's Studies program. Her first book, Changing the Subject, Women's Discourses in Feminist Theology, examine the liberating practices of non-feminist church women and feminist academics through the lens of post-structuralism and Marxist/feminist literary criticism. Very interesting. Her recent book, Places of Redemption Theology for a Worldly Church, explores the practices of an interracial church, the United Methodist, that includes people with disabilities, in contrast with theology's typical focus on beliefs. This project offers a theory of practices and place the foregrounds the effective reactions and communications that shape all groups, particularly around perspectives of otherness. All of this to say that these two wonderful women who are putting this book together have a lot of background and insight into theology and feminism and the combination of the two. And then it's highlighted in the projects that they're doing and the jobs that they have. And that is why they decided to put this book together and why we should take a minute to pay attention to what they're saying. And again, as I mentioned before, it is okay if you read these books and you're like, who gives a shit, or I don't agree, that's fine. But the idea is that as you're picking these books to read, it's important to know, what are these people's background? Are they even qualified to talk about these topics? And again, as we have read through these two people's bios, they have a lot of background and understanding about this topic. And actually, this goes beyond just these two as well. There's other authors that are in this book that they offer bios on them as well in the first few chapters. And you are able to see that they also have some background into feminism and theology, and it's pretty cool stuff. And so from here, I will talk a little bit about why I chose this book. As I kind of mentioned before, this is a book that I've read in the past, and obviously why I chose it for this podcast is to give you an opportunity to kind of see how I've changed my thinking over time and kind of hear how I've deconstructed from these books in a way that kind of gives you a chance to get to know me a little bit as well. So then in the future, as I'm kind of deconstructing my worldview through books that I'm choosing in real time, because it's just like, oh, this is interesting to me, I'm going to read it, you can kind of have track with me through some of the books that I've already read to kind of, you know, see where I'm at. So if we look at why I chose to read this book to begin with and in my past, I actually, as a student at Florida International University, I was going through a lot of different emotions and feelings, especially as a student leader with the campus ministry, struggling with my faith, struggling with how, you know, women were being treated in our group, and especially just in general in the church. And I kind of wanted to expand my understanding of what women really go through. And funny enough, like, it started with this psychology and women class that I took as a psychology student. And from there, I was introduced to the concept of feminism. And feminism was always something that I feel like was frowned upon in the evangelical tradition. It wasn't always like explicit, but I feel like, you know, it was one of those things that I just kind of always knew that we were kind of being, you know, taught to stay away from. Even to the point that I do remember there was a time that I was in CRU, which is Campus Crusade for Christ. There was a meeting that we had where they were weekly meetings and we did worship beforehand, and then there was a talk and all this stuff. And during one of the talks, one of the leaders was like, oh, if you're a feminist, a Buddhist, a Hindu, and it wasn't that she was saying anything bad about these people per se. I think it was in a conversation of like how to engage people that think different from you or something like that. But it was very interesting to already hear or feel this sense of like there's something wrong with feminism that shouldn't be connected to Christianity. And it was really funny because then later on when I actually learned about what feminism was, it cracked me up, because if it wasn't for feminism, her ass wouldn't be able to stand in front of the stage and even speak, because if it wasn't for feminism, we wouldn't be allowed to vote. We wouldn't be allowed to go to school. We wouldn't be allowed to work. You know, we would still be property, even though there's sometimes we're still kind of treated like property. But it was just very interesting to recognize later on, like, damn, like there seems to be this push against feminism in the Christian church. But then when you really think about it and you see that we struggle with patriarchy and all that shit, it's not really surprising. But my point is to say, like, me taking the psychology of women class kind of sparked my interest in the intersection of like feminism and theology, and kind of seeing how those two worked and if they could work, because again, my understanding of it was that they couldn't, right? And so as I took this course, I will say the book, the image that they used for the book was very jarring at first. You guys will see when I post the image of this, you know, on my Instagram feed. But basically, it's like pregnant women that are like on a cross. And I think because my only understanding of the cross was always tied to Jesus being on it, I was like, oh my God, this is so wrong. This is sacrilegious or whatever. There's something wrong with this. It's blasphemy, right? But then later on, as I've learned that Rome used the cross as a way to make sure people weren't fighting against their empire, I piped down a bit, but I will say at first this image made me a little uncomfortable. But I also like that they use this image because of the fact that it makes you uncomfortable and it makes you have to be like, what the hell is in this thing, right? So like we always do every week, let's look at what is the general topic or the general issue that the writer's kind of covering. And obviously I did mention it already in the little blurb that I read from the back of the book, but basically, as the author said, that they basically want to try to present an inclusive account of feminist theology in the earliest 21st century that acknowledged the reflection of women on religion beyond the global north and its forms of Christianity. The authors kind of chose this idea of globalization as a central theme and the primary characteristic of the context in which they do feminist theology today. And this is important to note because the global north as I was like looking that up, because I was like, what, just in case people don't know what that is, it's probably important to look at. So the global north consists of the richest and most industrialized countries, which are mainly the northern parts of the world. And so from my short little Google search, they try not to use this term anymore, which I can understand why. But obviously, when you look at the global north, of course, the United States is in there. We have, you know, Europe, Russia, Israel, Japan, Australia is in this, surprisingly, Canada. So basically all the countries that are kind of looked as like the first world countries, which again, I understand why they don't want to use this word anymore, but it's important to understand the context. So that's why I made sure to look it up and noted it. And then obviously, because, you know, the Christian worldview has kind of been a thing that's been globalized through popular media, through music, missionaries, you name it. I think it's important that they, you know, that we acknowledge that too. And they kind of acknowledge that as well, is that like, we want to go beyond that, because that is one of the things that's kind of permeating through all of our world. And obviously, there's other people represented, and it's important to acknowledge that. And I think this is such an important piece to this book. And because, like I've kind of mentioned before, I think when we think about theology, at least for me, my mind automatically goes to Christianity and studying the Christian God. And that's because that's something that's just been socialized in me for so long that now I'm having to rewire and be like, oh yeah, but theology is more. Theology also covers studying, like, you know, divinity of other religious beliefs that, well, at least it should encompass that. But again, because we've all been socialized to only think of theology in the Christian sense, it does take some time to kind of unlearn that. So I do think that it's a cool thing about this book is that they're trying to be intentional to bring up other religious backgrounds and understandings in the way that they talk about, you know, feminism. And so I do like the way that these authors did go about, you know, kind of talking about these different points. I think they did a very good job of like bringing case studies, bringing people from other cultures, giving us stories, research. I will say that one of the criticisms that I have of this book is the fact that most of this book is so saturated or just covered in words that you're just like, I need a thesaurus or a dictionary near me to get through this book. I think that's one critique I would give of this book, is like, it's not really, I don't know if the word would be user friendly, but reader friendly. And so I think that's where, for me, I have a hard time with academics, because I feel like we do so much, like we talk to ourselves all day long, but we forget that like, if we want people to engage in our shit, like we need to also use language that people that aren't academics, that they can actually engage in our material without feeling like they're stupid. So yeah, that's one of my critiques of this book. Because even with me, I have a master's degree, and I was sitting here like, what the hell is this word? And then couple it up with my Haitian background, there was words that I'm like, oh God, I sound like I have like the worst accent, because I'm trying to figure out, and you might even hear it in this episode, and I apologize in advance. But the point is, my critique of this book is that there's parts of this book that's not written in ways that you're like, okay, this is easy to understand. Most of it, I will say, it's easy to understand, but every once in a while, you'll get to a sentence where it's like, okay, now I have to use context clues and a dictionary to figure out what this word means, right? But all of that aside, I want to talk about a few things that kind of stood out to me that I thought was important, that was cool. First, I did think it was important to kind of talk about feminism and define it. Because I think in general, if you just say the word feminism, instantly people will have strong feelings to it. Which isn't bad in itself, like having a reaction isn't a bad thing. But again, as like I've mentioned in previous podcast episodes, I think it's very important before we really dive into a topic to define it in a way that, from my perspective and from your perspective, we have like a clear definition of what I'm talking about. before we, you know, dive into a conversation or discussion about it. So briefly, feminism can be defined as a broad social movement devoted to improving the lives of women everywhere, right? And so to take this definition further, I also looked it up on Wikipedia. Again, Wikipedia, I know, is not always like the best source, but to give you like a nice, you know, more well-rounded definition, I thought they did a pretty good job. So obviously, I'm going to read some of that. You can always feel free to go to the Wikipedia page and click other links and actually look up the sources, because I did find it very interesting and helpful. But they define feminism as a range of social movements and ideologies that aim to define and establish the political, economic, personal, and social equality of the sexes. Feminism incorporates the position that society prioritizes the male point of view and that women are treated unjustly within those societies. Efforts to change that include fighting against gender stereotypes and establishing educational, professional, and interpersonal opportunities and outcomes for women that are equal to those of men. And then they go kind of on to explain how some of the feminist movements out there have been used to campaign for women's rights, which includes like the right to vote, to hold public office, work, earn equal pay, own property, receive education, enter contracts, have equal rights within marriage, have maternity leave. And feminists have also worked to kind of ensure access to legal abortions, social integration, and to protect women and girls from rape, sexual harassment, domestic violence, and just in general, like changing the standards of like how we have to dress, what's considered acceptable physical activities for us to do, et cetera, et cetera. And so obviously, you know, given that the Christian faith tends to be very against women thinking for themselves and, you know, all this other shit, it makes sense that the reaction of a lot of evangelical circles, especially, you know, as I was younger, was to not introduce feminism into the spaces that we were in. Because I do remember there was a point in my childhood where, like, women wearing pants was like, oh my God, like, and now, you know, obviously a lot of us are wearing pants and nobody died. But it's just very interesting to see how much has changed and how much, you know, the powers of be, these men's usually, are working so hard to keep these structures together. Because, you know, of course, like, giving women equal rights means that they're going to lose some of their power and some of their privileges and stuff. And so, obviously, that's a hard thing for people to grasp with or wrestle with, especially if it means having to hold yourself accountable and change the structures that are you're benefiting from. And so, yeah, it's not a surprise that feminism isn't something that's hot in the church right now. Or I should say that it's not something that was hot in the past in the church right. But I know, again, some of that is changing because of feminist theology, right? And so I do think it was cool that they took some time to even define a little bit. In the book, they said it was like a movement that emerged in the 1960s and 70s in the context of the second wave of feminism. There's multiple waves of feminism. I think right now we're kind of in like the fourth wave of feminism, where we're seeing a lot of like the Me Too movement stuff coming out within like regular aspects of society, but then also in the church. I know for a while I've also seen like the church too hashtag kind of trending on Twitter, where there's a lot of people who are bringing up how in religious spaces they've had to deal with unwanted sexual harassment and all these different things. So I think that's kind of where the fourth wave is right now. I could be wrong, but I didn't feel like really diving into what wave we're in, because that's not really that pertinent to this. But what the authors are noting here is that basically from the second wave in the United States of feminism, there was a lot of activism from the white women. And from this activism, feminist theology kind of emerged, and it shared concerns that were similar to the other things I described in the beginning, talking about, you know, like the women's rights, anti-discrimination, protection from sexual and domestic violence, all that stuff. And so as this theology kind of, you know, formed, it kind of took on gender issues that were particular to the Christian religious community. They tried to promote women's access to official church leadership. They tried to critique the patriarchal nature of the Christian tradition and also the institutional structures. And ultimately, the point was just to try to add to the ability for women to have their own agency and their own history within the church. And obviously, that was met with backlash, and I think it still kind of has its backlash. But I think this movement of feminist theology is kind of why a lot of us have roles in the church as women, which is a good thing, but I know people will have their opinions on that. So after we define, you know, feminist theology, theology in general, feminism, all that stuff, I think it was also cool that they took some time to unpack what the hell globalization is, because especially for people like me, when I was first reading this book, I had no idea. You know, I think globalization is a thing that like impacts us on a day-to-day basis, but we don't really realize it because it's such an ingrained part of our society that sometimes we don't even know that it's really there unless we're told that it's there, right? So I do like that they take time to kind of define it for us. And so they look at defining globalization by just giving us three different characteristics of globalization. The first being global capitalism. And this characteristic is basically saying that in the 1980s, socialism kind of ended, and then capitalism kind of became the sole economic system for the globe. And so as we kind of saw this transition happen, a good thing is that there was a lot of more creative ways of using capitalism. And they kind of highlight, for example, how Bill Gates kind of has used the capitalistic system to kind of address some global poverty issues and AIDS and HIV. But obviously a con to this system is that there's like a gap between the rich and poor that just continues to widen. And then also we see that a lot of women in the global South and women of color in the West are kind of just always at the bottom. The next characteristic that they've brought up was this idea of an alteration of the role and the power of the nation state. And so they kind of say that there was like a shift from center periphery model of colonialism to a multipolar model. And so this is one of the definitions, I guess, where I was kind of like, eh, we probably could have done a better job of explaining this. But I think what they were trying to kind of highlight is that the problem is that this new model kind of does not deal with injustices and balances of colonialism's economic legacies. And also development in this model has always meant leaving the wealth accrued by the West during the colonial period intact, while kind of stimulating economic growth by the successful implementation of capitalistic models outside of the West. So they kind of highlight how places like Japan, China, and India have economic success kind of similar to the U.S., but at the same time, they're like using a lot of the exploitive practices of colonialism, which is not good for a lot of their people overall. So at the end of the day, these authors kind of bring up this issue or this characteristic because they're kind of highlighting the importance of feminists to analyze globalization, because oftentimes globalization leads to unjust power relations that affect all people, and especially since it affects women too, it's important to add that to the conversation, right? And then with the last key feature, the authors kind of look at the impact of globalization on culture and communication. And they kind of note that different communication technologies have kind of allowed for an unprecedented amount of rapid spread of information, images, and cultural narratives all over the globe in ways that kind of constantly alter and create what we know in the present. And I thought it was interesting because they talked about it like with this term of McDonaldization of the global culture. And they use this term McDonaldization to define the way that we kind of see that there's like a dominance of Western culture and what is both like the promotion and the global distribution of images and products. And then this term also signifies the homogenization or like making everything uniform or the same that does not adequately account for the resistance and creative production of non-Western cultures. And so this is basically saying how because of globalization, Western cultures, especially like American culture, I should say, is kind of saturated like all over the globe in a way that kind of diminishes the abilities of non-American cultures to, you know, create and produce their own stuff and all that stuff. And I think that's very interesting to think about, especially when we're talking about, you know, theology. And again, how I even mentioned in the beginning of this thing of like when I thought about theology, my norm was American Christian theology, right? And that's the only thing I knew about theology until I actually forced myself to expand my worldview and recognize like, okay, yes, Christianity is a perspective of theology, but it's not all of theology, right? And so it's the same thing with, I think, like Western culture. And what we're seeing in this term McDonaldization is the fact that Western culture has saturated everything, that anytime you think about culture, I think you kind of see that Western culture becomes the dominant. And I mean, you can argue that all day long, but I think the reality is we see that in like almost anything. Because when you talk about like, for example, theology, again, you only see white American theology as the norm. And then when you want to talk about other theologies, it's always like Asian theology, feminist theology, Black theology. Like, so the norm is always this white heterosexual norm, you know? And so I think it's important to kind of think about that. And I like that with this way that they talk about globalization, they're kind of setting the stage for us to kind of understand why they approached this topic of feminism with that lens, because it was something that they were trying to, I don't know, kind of address and also bring to our attention. You know, and I do think that they do a very good job of this in later chapters when different authors bring in their different stories and perspectives and ideas. And the one thing I really loved about in the intro is that they also bring up this idea of transnational feminism. And with transnational feminism, this is a way that they kind of try to practice this idea of anti-globalization politics. And they kind of note that it accepts that globalization has revealed the increasing redundancy of such simple dichotomies, such as like Western, non-Western, first world, third world. It sees anti-globalization struggle as fighting not against the compression of space and time in the cultural flows of our contemporary world, but against the boundless commodification of culture and indeed of every area of human life. It seeks to use communication infrastructure of globalization to undo it as a political economy by creating transnational networks of feminists, activists who repeatedly cross the borders of places, identities, and beliefs that divide us. And so they say that the trans feminist practice of solidarity is especially relevant to feminist theology in its multiple and interconnected contexts as we struggle with effects of globalization on women's lives, Therefore, it is crucial for us as feminist theologians to think through the implications of such radical world forces for the discourse that has long stood for the liberation of women and the transformation of complex social structures that continue to prevent women's flourishing and render invisible the significance of gender. So I really loved this idea of transnational feminism, especially as a practice, because with me, I'm always like a person that's like, man, like, how can we work together to fuck up these systems? And I love that, you know, in this book, these authors are kind of starting with that kind of mind frame of like, you know, it's okay that we all come with these different backgrounds, these different ideas of God, these different traditions, and all that stuff. But we all have a common thing is that, you know, these structures that we're living under are oppressive and that they're hurting us, especially hurting us as women. And if we can figure out how to come together in a single like unit and be, you know, co-conspirators, it can make the world a better place. That's kind of what I've read from this. And so I really like this idea of being a transnational feminist, especially given that, you know, in the United States, it could be so easy to just be wrapped up in only what's going on here as a country, especially as women. Like, I know recently the concern has mainly been about, oh, now this Roe v. Wade thing and how it's only affecting, like, you know, certain women and blah, blah, blah. Well, it's affecting all women, but I feel like, you know, not to trivialize what's been going on with the Roe v. Wade stuff and the things about abortion, that's not a good thing, obviously. But I think one of the interesting things for me is that, you know, the backdrop of this is like, there were a lot of Native Americans in this country that are being like trafficked and are missing that nobody's talking about. There were a lot of women who are being put in these camps because they've immigrated here that they were giving forced hysterectomies to, that's not being talked about, right? And just globally, like the way that women are being treated, that we're not really talking about some of those things. But the moment that it kind of like affected something that was here in our, and I guess on our own turf, that's when we kind of were like, oh no, like not my rights, you know? And I think, you know, when we really think about what it looks like to care about all women, it's not saying that one of these things are more important than the other, but it's saying that we need to be willing to speak up with all of these different issues, not just the issues that may be important to us or that affect only us, you know? And so that's something that I really wanted to kind of highlight because I really liked this way of thinking. So another thing that stood out to me in this book was from this chapter where the author talks about trans-ethnic feminism theology. And this was from like Asia. And this person's name was Nansum Khan. And I hope I said her name right. I love this chapter because she started it off with a banger. She started it off by saying, questioning the invisible assumption of the dominant group is the beginning of resistance for liberation. Those who are in the center do not ask the who am I question because they are the normative. Their identity is self-evident and therefore there is no need for further explanation. For them, such a fundamental question as who am I is either an existential question or a spiritual one, but hardly a socio-cultural or geopolitical question. Therefore, they do not need an adjective for the entry point of their discourse. So then she goes on to describe how these entry points for us are like Asian feminism, Latino, Latina, womanist, gay, and so on. And then she says, the absence of such an adjective make people think as if they are genderless, raceless, classless, or have no sexuality. This hidden universalizing practice among the dominant group needs to be addressed, especially those people who happen to belong to a dominant race/ethnicity need to be aware that they also belong to a specific racial slash ethnic group, because to ignore white ethnicity is to redouble its hegemony by naturalizing it. And without specifically addressing white ethnicity, there can be no critical evaluation of the construction of the other. And then she later goes on to quote this guy named Zilla S. Steen that says, "Whiteness silences itself by pretending that it has no meaning, no particular relation to a cultural privilege that is power filled." And I think this is just important because she's just kind of highlighting how, like, a lot of the times when we belong to a dominant group, we really have to think about it. We really name it. But then people that are marginalized constantly have to identify themselves by the name that they have to do. So, for example, as an able-bodied person, I never have to think about being able-bodied, or I never have to think about me being heterosexual. But a lot of people who have to battle the shit that comes with being in the LGBTQ community, or the shit that comes with not being able-bodied, they're constantly having to name it, see it, address it, you know. And I think about it even with me as a Black woman. I constantly have to think about my Blackness, because anywhere I step, there's something that I have to kind of address because of my Blackness. And it's not because I want to, it's because it's just how life is a lot of the time. So I like that she kind of, you know, brings that up and how important it is to name things. And then she kind of goes on to this idea of, like, as basically as, like, feminists, she's encouraging this idea of being political, but not being politicized. And I think this is such an important distinction, because I think we're kind of living in this world right now where everything is being politicized and we're not really open to being political, right? And I like how she, you know, talks about it. In this chapter, she kind of goes on to say that being political in feminist theology kind of gives rise to public awareness and responsibility for what is going on in reality, while being politicized kind of leads to blind extremism, which again is kind of what we see in our, you know, world currently, where you can't have a political conversation now without it just going to the extremes, right? I think another good way that she defines being blatantly politicized is by looking at it as being made to serve interests and ends imposed by militant groups, whether in the name of heightened racial awareness, true biblical morality, androgyny, therapeutic self-esteem, or all the other sorts of enthusiasms in which we are currently awash. And so again, I think this is such a great and important distinction, because I think she's arguing that if we as feminist theologians take the time to really understand globalization, whose globalization that we're looking into, and kind of figure out how we can stand in these different, you know, issues in a way that really helps the benefit of women globally, we can kind of pay attention to ways of like how to actually be political in a way that's actually helpful to the cause, rather than just kind of get caught up in, like, again, being politicized or being used for as different talking points, you know. And as a social worker, for me, I felt like this was kind of like a cool idea to kind of think about, because oftentimes I don't think we really think about, you know, politics in that way, or like what it really means to be political. At least I know, you know, back in the day when I first read this book, I never thought about that. So I did like with this chapter how she uses her experiences as an Asian woman to kind of propose this idea of trans ethnic feminism. And she basically says that, like, with this perspective, it ought to produce not a blind universalism, but a relational and dialectical universalism that promotes shared sensibilities across the boundaries of class, gender, race, ethnicity, ability, or orientation without sacrificing the particular situationness of one's geopolitical and discursive location. And when she says discursive, she means, you know, the related location where you're from. She then goes on to say, this trans-ethnic positionality I propose further establishes a firm ground for the recognition of common commitments and will serve as a base for solidarity and coalition among those who work for the betterment of our society. So I like that. And so she's basically saying here that when we look at trans-ethnic feminist theology, first it should lead us to have like a good conversation and practice of like taking time to really critically analyze like the social and geopolitical locations that we're in. And then from this movement of talking and criticizing these spaces or analyzing these spaces, it kind of will move us into action where we can kind of work together towards a common good. And again, like for me, you know, growing up in this American society where I'm seeing how being individualistic is such a huge, like, I don't want to say turn on, but kind of like it's such a big part of our society to be individualistic. I was really drawn to the ideas of this chapter because I like that she proposes that we can use our ethnicities to be a way for us to kind of get to know each other and also find unifiers and find ways to work together. It doesn't have to be something that we use to kind of separate ourselves from each other, right? And then again, I know, like, given the fact that there's so many different types of ethnicities and backgrounds, that's often difficult to try to figure out how to work together in a way that makes sense. But again, the idealistic part of me loves the idea that, you know, we can at least try, you know, and that was one of the biggest takeaways for me with this chapter. And then another chapter that I really enjoyed, honestly, there was a lot of different chapters, so I'm not really going to go through a lot of them, but another one that really stood out to me, though, was this chapter entitled Globalization and Gender Equality, a Contribution from a Latino Afro-Feminist Perspective. And this was written by Maricel Manalo. And so with this, she kind of introduces the idea of Latin American feminist theology, or she calls it TAFLA. And briefly, she says that, you know, this comes from the need to create theology from the experiences of community and religious life of women of Christian faith and women of faith of African origin and Latin American / Caribbean countries. And so this theology to her is kind of concerned first and foremost with situations of like racism, sexism, classes, colonialism, and anti-Semitism, which she says kind of mark the life experiences of the oppressed in our society. And so I like this theology because it kind of recognizes itself as one that kind of looks at the divine from the perspective of like poor Black women. And its aim is kind of to deconstruct the political systems of like enslavement. And it kind of looks at doing that through like protests, even if that means like silent protests or like by touching through songs, poems, meals, and slogans. It expresses itself through a process of liberation and faith in Black women, ultimately. And then she goes on to add that TAFLA does not spring only from the pain caused by the discrimination and racism lived by Black women, but also from their struggles and resistance. It is a theology that goes beyond the mere inclusion of Black women in the category of poor, obviously without forgetting that we continue to be slaves to hunger, disease, and the highest rates of unemployment. However, Afrofeminist theology rescues Black women from the role of poor servant or slave, a role invented by the learned creators of social religious imagery. Since we know that Black women was reduced to this role by the cruel genocide, plundering, and slavery of her people. It sets Black women up as the protagonists of a history of struggle and resistance, even while the official history tries to hide her power, wisdom, and resistance. In this way, our theological reflection aims to eliminate the hiding places of classism, racism, and sexism, camouflaged in theological and biblical erudition. And erudition here basically means like scholarship. So basically, they're saying that it's trying to eliminate classism, racism, sexism, that's kind of camouflaged in a lot of our biblical and theological scholarship. And so for me, that really resonated with me, especially because I have grown up in a lot of predominantly white spaces where a lot of the times when I did see images of Black women, it's always like not really represented well. And we're not usually the protagonists. A lot of the times we're usually the sidekicks, or we're like the slutty or the slave, or like we're all these different derogatory type of roles and not really seen as like women that can be powerful in their own right and can do things, you know? And so I like that this author introduces a theology that kind of wants to remind us that Black women can be more than that. And I as, you know, we go further into this chapter, the author kind of goes on to describe the historical background of the marginalization of women and the African-American people under globalization. She kind of starts by briefly describing the three different phases of the Industrial Revolution and how in each phase, essentially, you saw the promotion of racism and classism and the exploitation of people of color. And here she kind of focuses specifically on women, specifically Black or African-American women. And like one thing that really stood out for me in this section was the fact that, you know, you kind of see a rise in racist theories during the 19th century of colonialism. And the author really like notes here that these racist people were like using science and trying to create scientific claims about how certain races were more inferior. And they kind of use this to kind of justify the need for colonialization and control. And so in this time frame, you kind of see that African Americans were treated with contempt and depicted as devils, and a lot of their religious spaces or places were defiled and their icons were destroyed. And then the author kind of adds how, because a lot of these women were active in their roles in ancestral like religious cults, they were often branded as witches and sorceresses, and their bodies were violently stereotyped as ugly, dirty, evil, and a lot of horrible things would happen to these people, which, you know, I kind of was like, well, not much has changed, especially when you think about anything that's like non-white. I think automatically anything that's non-white or non-Judeo-Christian, it's automatically seen as there's something wrong with it. And there's like this intrinsic thing of like attacking it, which I might talk about another day. But I really saw this in, like, for example, when the music video Black is King with Beyonce that she created, automatically it was seen as like demonic without taking the time to recognize like not all Black people are Christians. And also, Disney is not a Christian network. It's okay to have other faiths be represented. And it was a thing. But my point is that we kind of see every day, if it's not this box of like white evangelical Christian, especially in this country, it's evil and we don't want to talk about it, right? So again, not much has changed. But I did enjoy that after the author kind of went through all this history, she shared a little bit about social and political and religious inequality that she's kind of noticed from the Afro-Colombian experience. And then she then kind of transitioned into discussing the impact of Black feminism on religious studies. And, you know, she then kind of ends with the Afro-Colombian response to the globalized world from a, like a social perspective and a religious perspective, which was nice. And I did really enjoy reading this chapter because I know just in general, when I first started learning about feminism, it is hard sometimes because it is white-centered. I think one of the things now that I'm deeper into my journey, a lot of the times when somebody says they're a feminist, I have questions because my question then becomes, could you really see yourself as like a feminist or a womanist, especially if you're white? Because I think, you know, as I've learned more over time, I think there has been a fair critique on like white feminism, because of the fact that white feminism really focuses on the things that just bother white people or like that really affect just white women. And that usually is like equal pay and, you know, maybe abuse. And like it's a very small, you know, window of things that they'll talk about. But when you want to, you know, go down and talk about how classism is affecting other women too, or racism, it's hard to touch upon those topics because then it means white people have to address white supremacy. And that's something that a lot of the times white women have a hard time wanting to wrestle with. And so I did like in this part of the book, or they just introduce the idea of womanism and how different women of color kind of, I guess, like advocated for themselves and kind of expanded this idea of feminism. So it didn't just address the needs of like the middle class women, the middle class white women, I should say, but it also looked at the needs of other women that are being affected. And so, yeah, like as I was reading this again, it was a cool reminder because like later on, I might bring some of those womanist books into the mix in this podcast. But I was introduced to a lot of awesome, like especially like Black women, because, you know, that happened to be what I was interested in, or what I am interested in a lot of times. But I was introduced to a lot of Black womanist authors like Alice Walker, Andre Lorde, Monica A. Coleman, Zora Neale Hurston, just different people that kind of opened up my mind and my perspective. Oh, bell hooks is another one. And I know there's also a lot of great Native American, you know, feminists out there, and Latino, Latina feminists out there too, that kind of open, that can do the same for people in those communities. So I think that's what I like about, I guess, the womanist worldview, is that, you know, they try to expand it a little bit more to not just the white woman plight or what they're dealing with, but also looking at, okay, what are other women of color also dealing with? And I think the womanist perspective is also pretty cool, because basically when feminists were out here fighting for their rights to vote, there was a period in time where they literally were trying to shit on Black people or Black women and kind of side with white supremacists so that they can get their views across. And that became a whole thing. So I will post like resources on that, because I just think that history is very interesting. So I did read about it a little bit. But my point in saying all this is that I really enjoyed this chapter because it did expand my understanding of these different Black feminist thoughts. And eventually in the future, I did in grad school start reading a little bit more about liberation theology and all that stuff, but this book was kind of a precursor. Like, it kind of warmed me up to the idea of that, especially since before I cracked open anything from this book, I just had no idea about feminism to begin with. So I was just really thankful that, you know, I was introduced to this book. So obviously, before we start heading into the end of the show, I'm going to talk a little bit about just how this book forced me to kind of reflect and see how I related to myself, society, and just like some personal things that came up as I was reading this book. And so I think one of the things that kind of like challenged me, or maybe forced me to think about my world differently when I first read this book, was obviously the idea of feminism. Like I said, you know, when I first was introduced to feminism, something in me reacted and I was like, oh no, like we're not supposed to, like that word or think about that word or interact with people that are feminists. And then as I actually learned about feminism, I was like, okay, I don't see what the problem is. And I think this word, again, for me is probably one of those words where maybe there's a differing opinion on maybe how we go about doing policy around feminism, or maybe how we go about, you know, especially when you think about what is a just world look like for men and women so that it's equal. Maybe you might have some differing opinions on what policies we can do to make that happen. But the idea that men and women should be treated equally should not be so groundbreaking and cause this much drama. It should be something we should be like, yes, you know, I think it's, for me, it's like the same thing with like race. The fact that we are, you know, making Black Lives Matter into like this big, oh my God, this is like a politicized thing and there's something wrong with it. It's like, what is wrong with saying that Black Lives Matter? Or what is wrong with saying that people matter? Like any group of person matters. That shouldn't be an issue. It shouldn't be a political statement. It should just be something that is, you know? So I think for me, the fact that this book kind of opened me up to the idea of feminism and what it really meant. And that was awesome. And again, like, I think at first I was kind of like, oh, you know, I struggled with it because, you know, being the good Christian girl that I wasn't sure. But then also just knowing that there were a lot of Christians that were involved in this movement of feminism to begin with, but we don't talk about that either. that also solidified for me, you know, this idea that I needed to explore this topic a little bit more. And then I think also this concept of globalism, it made me think about things a little bit different around that, especially I think like now when I think about globalism and I think about especially how the globalism can be tied to like what we do with missionary work, it makes me think a little bit more about if we're actually doing good or harm when we're promoting globalism. Because I don't think there's anything wrong with globalism in the sense that we can be connected to each other more and we can find different ways to communicate with each other and all that jazz. But I think my issue with colonialism is usually when we're forcing our ideals or ideas or our ways of living on other religions. And so for me, that I guess that kind of reminded me of something that I learned while I was at Loyola. There's this idea of subsidiarity. And it basically like is kind of looking at the government, like their role and how they're supposed to interact with people, right? And so this is part of like the 12 Catholic social teachings or whatever. And with subsidiarity, basically it's saying that the state is an instrument to promote human dignity and protection of human rights and develop the common good. But this term subsidiarity holds that such functions of the government should be performed at the lowest level possible. As long as it can be performed adequately, when they cannot, then higher levels of the government must intervene. And so the reason I think this connects to my idea around globalization is because I think oftentimes the default is to kind of like look at how the West is doing what they're doing and then just kind of forcing that on other countries. I think America is very big on doing that and we never talk about it. But I like this idea of subsidiarity because if we look at it from the globalization point of view, different countries should have the right to, you know, fix their government or do things for their country that works for their country. So if it does look like doing capitalism, then sure, do capitalism. If it does look like being a little bit more socialist, I think that's open. Like, you know, those things need to be decided within the country. Obviously, you know, this crazy communism thing, I'm not promoting that because it's been harmful. I get it. I'm also not promoting this wild ass capitalism that we have here where we can't even take a break for a global pandemic, right? But the idea is that, though, you need to let these governments figure out things for their country. And if they really need help, then yes, other countries should be able to intervene and help and all that stuff. That's not bad. But the fact that a lot of the times, like I think, especially as the U.S., there's a lot of U.S. interference in these other countries. I think globalization, you know, now I think about it and I'm like, ugh, I don't know if that was necessarily a great thing. And I say this being that, you know, my family is, you know, from Haiti. I know I have a lot of other friends that their families have immigrated from other countries. And one of the things that me and some of my friends have talked about is how U.S. interference a lot of the times have created such an unstable environment for our countries. And it's not even just U.S. interference. It's, you know, effects of colonialism. Because I know with Haiti, for example, it's not just the U.S. interference, but it's also France. But because there's interference, it kind of affects what our countries can do and how they can care for themselves. And then now our country, like Haiti, for example, I feel like it's kind of in this place of more in hopelessness because it's had countries shit on it so many times. Figuring out how to come back and be a power that can help itself is difficult, you know? And so, yeah, so I think as I've read this book, it kind of made me think a little bit more about what does it really mean when we are promoting globalization and how does that really affect the countries that are taking part of this process. And then lastly, I think this book was great in that it challenged my ideas around like what really happens to women, especially outside of the United States. I don't remember if it was just this book or some other materials that I've read when I was in the class that I was introduced to this book, but just reading about like some of the realities that women have to go through in other countries and how patriarchy just globally is shitty to all women, no matter your religious background. I think for me, that was so eye-opening because I know in one of the books that I had to read while I was in this class, we read about women who were being circumcised in some countries and how painful that is, and you know how also some women were being like burned at the stake for reasons, and it's just crazy. And I think, you know, reading books like this is just a reminder that globally women are treated like shit, and always makes me, you know, sad when we don't remember that and we as women treat each other like shit. And so I think as I was like reading this book again and reflecting on it, I think that's why I really am drawn to the idea of unity among women, regardless of your race, because there's just so much shit that we have to deal with collectively that unfortunately men will never understand or care about. Or if they do, there's just like a small percentage of men that give a shit. So it's like if we're not, you know, seeing each other and trying to help each other through these different things, we're never going to change. And so again, that's where there's that critique of like those feminisms that it's just focusing on, you know, one race or whatever. It's not good. And again, sadly, it does end up being white women a lot. So yikes. But I do like that even from like, you know, the womanist perspective of feminism that I brought up earlier, it kind of went from that to this understanding of intersectional feminism and trying to understand that each person kind of have their own social and political identity that plays a role in who they are and also contributes to a certain level of discrimination and a certain level of privilege. And so I know with me, like when I talked about myself a little bit in the intro, I did, you know, bring up the fact that as a Black Christian woman who's able-bodied, middle class, and has all these different things, there's parts of me that experience a lot of privilege, and that would be that I'm a Christian, that I'm able-bodied, that I've had access to healthcare and education, that my family's middle class. So some of those have brought me privileges. But then as a Black woman and also as an immigrant, there's areas of my life where I've experienced some disadvantages or discrimination, right? So like I've said before, I think that's something that all of us have to constantly be aware of and be checking. And I think, you know, a lot of feminist, womanist, and intersectional thought really encouraged a lot of that thinking. And so if you are interested in growing more in this area, I do encourage you to check out this book because it's a good way to start your journey in learning about feminism and womanism, and eventually you can start moving your way into learning about intersectional feminism. And I would say that, you know, a good person to really learn about eventually once you're, you know, diving deeper into feminism is Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, because she's the one that kind of helped introduce and develop intersectional theories around feminism and all these different things, right? And I don't know, for those of you who are familiar or not familiar with her, she's also someone that helped come up with the critical race theory thing that everybody's pissed about. But she's obviously doing some good work. And yeah, I do recommend, you know, eventually moving from learning about feminism to really understanding more about intersectionality. Because I would say, outside of the Me Too movement, where feminism is moving to now in this whatever wave we're in is this idea of intersectionality, which I think is a good thing, because the more inclusive we can be in our conversations of, like, how do we fix our world, the better. And I know that idea is often scary to a lot of people, but I know for me, like, I would rather be, like, you know, unemployed in the sense of, like, you know, social work exists because of poverty and discrimination and all these oppressive systems, right? I would rather work towards eradicating them and possibly losing employment than keeping these systems alive and having to have social works continue to be a thing. And I know that's not something most people would say, given the debt that we go through to be in these damn schools to study social work. But at the same time, like, you know, I'm at a place where I'm like, ugh, I want better for us, you know? So with that said, I thank you all so much for listening to this week's episode. I know I hit y'all with a lot of information. And again, I will say, like, this book is great, but I know this book is also has a lot of, like, tricky words in here. So again, read this with patience, give yourself time. I think this book is laid out in a way that you can just, you know, slowly make your way through it and take in the everything little by little. I don't think it's a book that you have to read through fast. But like I said, it does offer a lot of great insight into, you know, feminist theology and, like, other faiths and different things. I know I mostly talked about, you know, theology from a Black perspective, and I think the both of the people that I talked about were mainly Christians, if I remember correctly. But again, it doesn't mean, like, that's the only thing that was in here. They really did talk about a lot of cool stuff in this book. So again, I do highly recommend it if you're interested in just expanding your worldview. And again, you may not agree with everything 100%, but at least it could be something that you can, you know, sit with, digest, and just think about, you know. And so again, I thank you all so much for joining me this week, and I look forward to hanging out with you guys and talking through another book again next week. In the meantime, please enjoy my outro. Hey there, and thank you for joining me on this week's episode of Critical Reads. To find out more about me or to consume more of my content, please feel free to visit my website, soulsessionswithneff.com, where I share a variety of things, including blog posts, resource lists, and have a regularly updated calendar for this podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook using the handle @soulsessionswithneff. While you're at it, if you really enjoy listening to Critical Reads, I encourage you to please subscribe to this show on iTunes, Google, or Spotify, and take some time to rate us on these different platforms. Your reviews will really help the show gain some visibility and also give me some much-needed feedback on how the show is doing. I thank you in advance for your time and your support, and until next time, this has been Neff with some Critical Reads.